The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And I have this idea that this mic is not working so well, so we're going to start with it and find out, because we need to know which one is not working. And I just came back from teaching a retreat for 2 weeks, and one of the phenomena of teaching a retreat is that sometimes I feel wonderfully empty at the end. This one idea of being wonderfully empty means kind of there's a certain kind of contentment, perhaps, just to be, simplicity of being, or the kind of a wonderful emptiness of I don't really have a lot of desires right now or things that I want to do, or I'm just happy to just to be here. It doesn't lend itself to showing up with a planned talk. So maybe my wonderful empty contentness is bad news for some of you. But I hope that maybe there's some appreciation, especially after 45-minute meditation, of if not through your own little bit of experience, but maybe through your intuition of how wonderful it is to just be here in an open, present way without voices of disgruntlement or criticism or conflict or feeling of inadequacy or feeling discouraged or feeling afraid, just here. So given that, with your permission, perhaps I can just answer questions today. Maybe you have some questions you'd like to ask, something that's been on your mind. Then we'll see what we kind of create together here this evening. Is it loud enough? Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah, so if you, there are mics right behind you. You can use that one. And it would be nice if you say your name before you speak, so we just... The green light.
Hello. My name's Suzanne, and I'm new to meditation by a few months. I find it incredibly beneficial so far, but I find it very challenging, and this might be addressed in the retreat that is coming up, but to bring the practice into work situation. It seems like there's a big wall there. I think from an interpersonal and friendship and family, there I feel like there's space for me to employ some of those skills that I'm practicing and learning. But at work, it just seems very difficult. And I don't know if there's anything to guide one in this and in this, but if it just takes more practice and...
I think it's a great question, and even more wonderful is the fact that you have this intention, this desire to bring it to work. And for some people, it is one of the more difficult places to bring it. One of the places it begins is for you to be clear about what you're trying to do when you bring the practice to work. And you have a clear intention. That this is, do you have any sense of what that might be?
Yes, I think to be more less reactive to the things that come up and the demands that are made of me during work. And it's a challenge because I feel like part of my reaction is what makes me good at my job. So it's like, how do I reconcile that? So maybe that's where the challenge comes from.
And in these couple of months that you've been practicing, what have you learned that's helpful in terms of being non-reactive?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that quite, because, like I said, it's very challenging. What I've learned is not to judge myself when that happens.
Mm.
So instead of fighting it, I'm after the fact. I kind of can reflect upon it,
mm-hmm.
And then try to recognize it when it happens again. Mm-hmm. So it's more like being aware that it's even happening.
Great, it's a great beginning.
And
it's a great, but outside of work, what have you found helpful in terms of being non-reactive? Since you said, talked about it being better for you and with family, friends, I think.
The triggers aren't there as much, so maybe it's not that it's easier to not be reactive. It's more like those triggers aren't there. But some of the things, I guess, would be. Just to take a beat and to be present, especially when it's one-on-one with friends, to really focus in on, and to also to set intention. I'm trying to practice that as well.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things I could say now. One is keeping the intention at work in the forefront. So you're reminded of often. A lot happens in the wake of, or in the follows the intentionality. So you might even have, you know, your intention, if you can have something that either write it out or have something that symbolizes it, and have that in a prominent place so you notice it regularly. Oh yeah, that's my intention. And that works like in the background of the mind, the back corners of the mind, and supports you and helps you to kind of try again or try more. The other is helpful if you understand the triggers really well. And if you know what the top three triggers are, can you then plan ahead? You know, so, you know, every time your boss walks into the room, I'm just making something up, right? That's a trigger. And so you make an intention for 1 week to really kind of focus, zero in on the phenomenon of boss walking in. What goes on there? What are you feeling? That's the time. Oh, as soon as you see the boss, take a deep breath. Breathe. And choose one thing and make it the focus of study, of investigation, of working with it for that week. And if that's productive, you can do it for a second week, or you can choose a different single task. And over time, it builds, and more the place at work becomes a place you're familiar with, you know the game, you know how your mind works, you know the triggers, you become wise to it, and you've learned how to be an alternative way. To try to bring to get a taste of what this practice can be like, be non-responsive, to be calm, to be wise, to be kind, and try to do the full bang version of it, you know, in difficult situations, it's just too unrealistic. So choose small chunks and slowly build.
Great, thank you.
You okay with the air conditioner on? Yeah? I keep turning it up, you know, up, but... Yes. Can we bring the mic over?
Okay, my name is Sylvie, and I've been wondering lately as I'm practicing more and more mindfulness and compassion, and in interpersonal relationships, like I'm like aware of things that people do that are really uncompassionate, and I was completely blind to that before, and. I kind of say nothing, I just note it, you know, but I feel like I would like to bring it up in a skillful way, and I haven't found that yet, without sounding like, you know, here's the Buddhist trying to tell you what to do.
Yes, that's a very nice, it could be wise, it could be not wise to do that. I think now you're talking about the graduate level graduate level mindfulness. You know, there's things that are particularly difficult in giving feedback to other people or talking to other people about their challenges, what they do, really takes a lot of skill. I think the beginning of it is don't speak to them until you really looked at yourself carefully. So you really know why you want to speak. What's your intention? Because sometimes there can be, and I'm not saying it's you, but there can be things, you can be self-righteous. It could be that you're uncomfortable. Not mean you particularly, I'm just generic you. A person can be uncomfortable, and they're trying to get rid of their own discomfort by fixing the problem out there, the person. It could be out of compassion. They see the harms being done to both other people, but also to themselves. People are uncompassionate, harm themselves, and just feel caring and want to try to support that or be helpful. So you have to be very, very clear about what's going on for you. And one, I think it's helpful to get to a place of kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but a place where you can abide peacefully without needing to do anything. If you have a need to do it, then you're hooked in, and it's a little dangerous. So see if you can do your own work and to find a place where you don't need to do it, and then you might be in a position to begin considering wisely what to do, and you can maybe see more clearly. The other thing to look for is probably you shouldn't also you shouldn't speak, unless it's a real, someone's doing something really harm in the world and you want to intervene. I can't allow this to continue. But the other thing is try to wait until you have some modicum of compassion for the uncompassionate person. Chances are is they're hurting. And so can you tune in to the way that their lack of compassion either comes from a place where they're hurt, where there's pain, discomfort from themselves, or it's causing them harm. It's causing, you know, it's making their life more difficult actually to do it. And see if you can get some modicum of compassion also for that person. So that's, so first, you know, have no needs of your own. Have some compassion. And then get all the street smarts you can. Just be as wise as possibly you can. Learn wise communication skills. Learn how to be skillful in how you talk so that you talk in a way that doesn't offend people, doesn't challenge them, that they don't shut down. Talk in ways that... So one simple way, for example, is to use a lot of... some people find it helpful to use a lot of I statements. To say, you know, wow, you are so uncompassionate. It's hard to believe. You should stop. That gets one response. But if you say, that was a pretty uncomfortable communication I just witnessed there. Did you see how uncomfortable that was? And at least I felt uncomfortable. And so you're not making a statement about them yet, but you're kind of opening the conversation in a gentle way. And they might say, yeah, it was uncomfortable. They might surprise you and say, yeah, it was uncomfortable. I really am troubled by how often I don't have compassion. You know, this is a difficult area of my life, and I spoke too quickly or something. And then you can have a whole different conversation, but if you start off with saying you and don't give them a chance, then they close up and they went down. So to start in a way that's not, you know, just very soft or gentle and also personal, you know, I was really uncomfortable watching that. Were you uncomfortable? What was going on there? That was difficult to watch. What was going on there? And then you might then look for the doors that open, so you might be able to take a step further. And then you're building to being able to give them some feedback. And it's really helpful. The other principle around giving feedback to people or making observations to people, most people really want to be listened to, and they want to be understood. So if you're willing to make an observation or feedback to someone, but they understand that you really want to understand what's going on with them, you're curious, you're interested, maybe by starting off by showing your interest and asking questions, that kind of makes them more willing to trust you or be willing to hear what you have to say. than if you just kind of jump in right away. So with that long answer, it takes a lot of skill. It takes a lot of care. That's okay? Yes, please.
Yeah, my name is Manohar. So one of the things in the teachings was about equanimity.
Yes.
And being disenchanted. But I find that, you know, when you meditate, fine, your mind is very calm and quiet. But the moment you see those things happening to other people, your near ones or in the news and things like that, it is very hard to reconcile that. You know, you just, that equanimity doesn't come. You feel burdened by sorrow of somebody, you know, mm-hmm. suffering. So is that an evolution process?
Is it an evolution process? I think so. I think we grow over time. One of the things to become, the word disenchantment is a very important Buddhist word. That for people who don't know kind of the Buddhist kind of way of talking, the vocabulary, it can seem like, you know, why would, you know, most people, disenchantment usually means you've been discouraged, you've kind of like let down, you're kind of like, it's a, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like a downer to be disenchanted. But the way it's used in Buddhist English, it's the opposite of being enchanted, the opposite of being under the spell of something. And being under the spell of something is not, you know, very healthy. So we want to break the spell. And some of the spell that we can learn and become disenchanted with is the value of being angry, the value of being blaming other people. The value, some of the reactions we have inside are not productive. And so when we start understanding that the way that I, you know, race to judgment of the situation, the way that I close down, resist what's happening, that doesn't serve me, it doesn't serve anybody, it's not really useful, then we start becoming disenchanted in some of those reactivities. And as we become more disenchanted, then we're more less likely to pick it up when it comes through. And so there's an equanimity, there's a balance. You might feel, you know, upset for a moment. You know, I've been there, done that. This is an old trick of the mind. It doesn't go anywhere. I've seen how the magic is done. I'm disenchanted. And so I don't want to go there. So a lot of it, becoming equanimous this way, the way I'm talking about, means understanding how you're not equanimous. And spending a lot of the mindfulness practice understanding what happens in you when you lose your equanimity, you lose your calm, and becoming wise about that. The byproduct of that is you're less likely to lose your equanimity. If you try to hold your equanimity, you just end up being stiff and tight. And then, you know, then at some point you might be walking around, you know, in Buddhist equanimity. Everything's going really fine. You know, yes, I'm equanimous. And then, you know, someone says something and you just explode because, you know, it's, you know, yes, you know, pent up. But if you understand if you're really wise about what causes you to lose your equanimity, then you're more likely to not give into it, not buy into it, not succumb to it. And then your equanimity is not held, it's not forced, it's just like more natural in a sense.
So do you go about, like, if you see something and like somebody else suffering and, or, you know, something happening, so do you go about changing that, or how would you, like, fine, you know, you're yourself balanced, but is there a way to help other people, or how do you show that?
I hope so. Yeah. I think it's a good question, but there's such a wide range of sufferings people have. And so, you know, if the person walking next to you on the sidewalk trips and falls down and is crying, stop and help them. You know, just take care of it. If you have a friend who is, you know, you hear from a, you know, from a mutual friend that another friend is a good friend of yours, maybe a relative died, and they're suffering from that. But, you know, the person lives someplace else, and, you know, you say, you know, and you notice yourself that you're all distressed, you're alarmed, you think, wow, the sky is falling, and you start running around your house like a, you know, trapped rat. I better go help the friend. you're probably not going to help your friend in that state. So you're probably better off then, because you don't need it to go to your friend immediately. Then you're better off kind of taking care of yourself, settling, meditating, understanding what's going on for you. So when you go, you're in a calm, better place to meet your friend. So when we actually go and act, and when we take care of what's inside, that depends on the situation, and hopefully we have enough wisdom to notice a difference. The thing about meditating regularly, like every day, is that it's really good to prepare for the time there's a crisis, for the time there's a real need. If you don't do any kind of inner practice, and you live your life, and then your friend has some difficulty, and you're like struggling and angry and upset and scared by the whole thing, you know, and then so I better you know, look at myself and meditate and get calm, but you don't know how to do it. You haven't developed the habit. You haven't developed the skill of it, the ability to do it. You don't know yourself well enough, and then it's kind of too late to learn it. So a fair amount of regular meditation is a proactive remedies, proactive support for times of crisis. Is that an adequate answer?
Yes.
Okay. I saw, yes, in the back. Is there another mic? That mic, if I may pass it all the way to the outer room.
Hi, Gil. My name is Xavier. I've been coming here for a few years, but we never talked. And I also didn't come here for a long time, unfortunately, for a very good reason. So I'm going to share a personal experience that ends up with something that some other people might have encountering. So I suffered of a very serious head injury because of a car accident. I was in coma for a long time.
Are you the one who went to San Francisco General?
No, so I visited lots of hospitals, if that's your uh-huh. question. So I was first in Reading, then in Santa Clara, uh-huh, then okay. in Stanford. And that was about a year ago. And I'm fine now, but there's still one thing that remains. And I want to talk about that with everyone, because I know lots of people in America suffer of that. This is tinnitus. It's called a ringing in the ear. And I'm suffering of that because I hit my head. And I have the strong conviction that meditation can help accepting it, because I know there is no way to make it disappear, or maybe right. maybe there is, but I didn't find. And I, at the moment right now, when I meditate, including today, I'm hearing the bell. I mean, I'm hearing my ear,
right.
my earring, and it's. I'm at the state in my recovery where I don't mind, but it's still disturbing me, and I accept it, but at the same time I want to get rid of it, so then that means I don't really accept it. and I think this is very connected to meditation, where you start getting to yeah. know yourself and accepting your problem, and you observe yourself and your problem. And maybe this is the proof that I'm very bad at that. And I wonder if one day I will stop hearing this, or if you know anything, because I'm sure meditation can help, yeah. at least with coping with the anxiety that I already did, but now I want to go to the next step, which is like getting rid of this shit.
Yeah, so it's a common enough experience, and I have it as well, and I'm always hoping no one reminds me.
Sorry.
Bring it up, and oh no, there it is. Because that's always there, you know. So, but you know, mostly it kind of recedes, and I don't. There are some issues in life, health problems, different things that are not going to go away. This might go away for you, but some things never go away, And the best we can do with a practice, we can't use, and to maybe use a practice to get rid of every problem is not unrealistic. What the practice can do is to help us establish a more realistic relationship to the challenge. So we get to look at our fears, our aversions, our frustrations that we have in relationship to it. And those can drop away. And the end result of that is that what was a challenge before becomes still maybe a practical challenge, but we're not psychologically bothered by it anymore. We're not troubled by it, so the mind can be at peace with it. And it might be hard work to get to with ringing in the ears to find peace with it, but the work to get there is really good work. And it, you learn so much about yourself that it's applicable in other areas of life as well. So there might be more work for you to do, and that's, you know, just be content that that's where you, you know, where the work is. It's possible as your healing improves, it maybe just takes care of itself. I don't know of any magic, you know, special practice that can help the ringing to go away. For some people, including myself, it seems to work very well to ignore it. One of the principles of mindfulness is to pay attention to things, pay attention to whatever is the most prominent phenomena. But I think that for me, that's one of the few things that I try to ignore the best I can, and not paying attention to it, because paying attention to it just makes it more strong. And occasionally, some people find it helpful to not meditate in completely silent environments, because that makes their ringing stronger. But to have some ambient sound, whether it's the window open, you hear traffic, or whether it's some soft music or water running or something, that can mask it and make it easier just kind of live with it as well. Now, in terms of concussion and brain damage, I don't have any clinical evidence for what I'm about to say, so probably not my business to say it, but I can say it as an act of, as a statement of faith, of what I've seen myself, what I've seen in others, is that the deep relaxation and ease, peace that can come from meditation, I think creates the optimal conditions for all kinds of healing, physical healing. And so if your brain is still healing from all that, I suspect that the meditation will help in some ways with some of that part of that healing. And maybe it'll help with somewhat.
So you were talking about ignoring, and this is something that I guess for other people, at least for me, it's very difficult. For instance, if you have a coworker or this something or someone you don't want to talk about or to think about, how do you manage not to think of this person or this thing? Because if you think of not thinking of that thing, then you think of that thing.
Yes. The other thing I can say about like ringing in the ears is that if it is really strong and it doesn't leave you, can't ignore it, then it can be wise to just turn your attention to it. And some people use it as their primary object of meditation. And they get very concentrated, very still, just focusing on that. Every time their mind wanders off, they come back. So that's also possible. And some people who do that way find that they do that for some while and get kind of settled on it. They start becoming very relaxed about it being there. And then it becomes easier just to go back to something like the breathing, and they don't feel pulled into that world.
Yes, that's why I started experimenting with. But so you're saying you can go both directions. And
yeah, and a big part of this practice of mindfulness is trial and error. And we're supposed to become our own teachers, and that we become our own teachers by trial and error. We try different things, so I would encourage you to try different things. Sounds like overall you're doing well.
Yes, I'm doing very very well, and I appreciate life even more since this accident.
Yeah.
So life is good.
Good. I'm happy to hear that. Thank you. Okay. So
sort of a, I don't know, instructional question or something. I think I could probably benefit from talking to a teacher sometimes about like what specific things I'm experiencing in meditation and so on. And you mentioned a few weeks ago the idea of us finding teachers to contact, but I don't really know how to go about doing that.
Uh-huh.
Can you give any advice on how to find a teacher that to interact with about meditation practice?
There's compared to 40 years ago, there's Buddhist teachers galore around the Bay Area. And so if you have one that you feel some affinity with, just ask them if they'll meet with you. Here at IMC, there's a number of ways of meeting with someone. And there, I think over time, we're going to have more people available for that. But most Wednesday mornings, that when I'm here, I offer 6 sign-up meetings with people. They're 15 minutes long. If you come to the Wednesday morning kind of half-day program we have. And then the day-longs that we do, that I do, that go from 8:30 to 5, there's also sign-up meetings there. So that's also 15 minutes, and that's also a good place to kind of check in and with me. I believe it's Andrea Fella still has her little sign on the bulletin board there that she's available sometimes when she's around early Thursday evening. And you, I think it's a phone number or email that you can call and check and see if she can meet with you. She's a great teacher. So those are what comes to mind first around here. But you know, there's all kinds of people you can ask. You can always ask, and then they have to deal with it. Yes.
I just wanted to address your...
Yeah, let's use the mic here.
And thank you for suggesting it for me. But Andrea Fella has just started a Thursday evening at 7:30. And so if you came, for example, this Thursday at 7:30, the class is quite small. And she's introducing a different... you know, there are many different ways to get to the sitting meditation, and so it always helps to have like many tools in your bucket. So she's introducing a Burmese style of not necessarily focusing on the breath. I think it's very good, and so there are 4 weeks, I think.
Nice, yeah.
So she just started it, so you could consider coming.
I have one more along those lines, too, that Andrea, she's also doing that daily life practice, too. And so that's wonderful. So it starts on Sunday, and then there's small group meetings during the week. And so she meets with the students, and everyone shares their experience. And I've attended one of those before, and it was just amazing just to jumpstart my practice. And then after the end of the week, too, then you can sign up and kind of continue on the practice with other students. But
yeah. And then the other thing is we have this Eightfold Path mentoring program. And it's not necessarily specifically meditation, but it is a way to meet with some of the mentors here at IMC on a monthly basis and explore the Eightfold Path, explore the practice in your life. And that's been a valuable program for lots of people. And the next one starts just in a couple of... A couple of weeks?
Started yesterday.
That was the introductory one, or... So that was, so you didn't have to go to that one, right? Right. So, the 9th of October, the next one, and Chris is leads that program, teaches it, and leads it. And you could check with Chris if you're interested in the Eightfold Path program. Any last one? One more? Yes.
I think a few months ago you were saying to us, if a tree falls in a forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it fall? In relation to if events happen in the world and we're not aware of them, are they happening? So I'm really interested in world events, political events that are happening, but if I choose to focus on my immediate sphere of influence and not be aware of it, but know that I can be compassionate about it. Are those events happening, and how can we be engaged in the world but not specifically pay attention to every nanosecond of information that's being sent to us?
I don't remember what I was teaching back then on that. but one response is that there's a difference between our imagination of what's happening and what's actually happening. And we want to be able to tease apart the overlay of projection, overlay of stories, imagination that we put on top of things and really see things directly for what they are, closer to what they are. And I think that if you look at how people relate to political events, to tragedies around the world, there's a tremendous amount of imagination that comes into play, and projections and opinions and all kinds of complicated phenomena that goes on. So one of the functions of this practice is not to make us oblivious to what happens around us, not to ignore the world. I think being a witness and being a eye, to, being present for what goes on in the world around us is an important thing. But it's very important to be able to tease apart the imagination from what's actually there, what we're adding to it. So this inner work of mindfulness is to help us make that distinction. And I think that's crucial. And so this idea that, at least in terms of the tree in the forest, if it falls, is there a sound? If there's no one there to hear it, is usually how it's worded. To give you a better example, I think, would be if a movie is being played in a movie theater, but there's no one in the audience, is there really a movie on the screen? And in fact, I think you would have to say, no, there's no movie there, even though the light is shining there. The reason being that in order to see a movie as a movie, as a motion picture, your mind has to take all these individual still shots that are flashed on the screen and construct them in the mind as movement. So there actually is no movie. You're co-creating it. And so to what degree is the co-creation of our life that we live in healthy, appropriate, wise, and how much do we overlay on top and how much we project on top? I think that's a crucial thing to discover. And so taking time to be alone and to practice more, to close your eyes and really be here and discover, my hope makes you then more available to the world to see it clearly without the filter of our projections. Is that an answer? Did I address your concern, or you want to try again?
That's my current concern. I think there sometimes there's an expectation that in order to be a politically involved or informed person, that there's a certain amount of information and a knowledge of current events that's expected, and then one could be described as someone who's has their head in the sand or is not aware, but concerned that there's this expectation of our society to have to some degree.
If you allow me, please, even to say expectation of our society, that's a generalization. That's already a projection. That's already an assumption about generalizing broadly. What society? Who are the people who have those judgments and ideas? Is it everyone? Is it the people you respect? Is it the news that says it? Is it reality TV? Where are you getting that impression? And to ask that question helps you maybe not give so much authority to the generalized kind of idea we're picking up from our society and be able to be more reflective for ourselves. I think that it's very contextual for people at different phases of their life, different life circumstances, different situations in the world, how much or how little they're going to be involved in society or involved with family or involved with all kinds of things. Someone who wants to become a doctor and doesn't have even an undergraduate college degree yet realize I have to go do an undergraduate. But I don't want to do that because I'm not helping people yet. I want to help people. I don't want to study, English and, all these kinds of subjects that require me in college. But, you have to take yourself out of the world for 4 years in order to hope to get into medical school where you can start maybe helping people. So there are times when it's appropriate to pull out. So, for example, it used to be, I haven't heard it for many years, but there are times people complained about the meditators because it was selfish. to go and spend this time kind of inward and looking in and being present. And you know, meditators don't meditate that much usually. You know, maybe, you know, they say they meditate 45 minutes a day. And the people who are complaining about them doing it, they watch 3 hours of TV a day. You know, it just something about meditation that kind of used to kind of touch a nerve, and like it seems, you know, if you're spiritual, you're not supposed to kind of be internal, it's supposed to be in the world. And but you know, to be, I don't know why I'm picking on doctors right now, but to be an effective doctor, helping the world and engaged in the world, it helps to take a shower from time to time. And it usually people shower alone. You know, there is a time to pull in, and so sometimes it's appropriate to spend time in working on yourself and cleaning yourself, and sometimes that means 45 minutes a day. For some people, in the context of their lives, it might mean the best thing they could do for everyone, the world itself, is to spend a year where they drop out completely from society. They don't know anything about what's going on in the world. And they do deep inner world, inner work that prepares them to come out and see what goes on in the world. So hopefully I'm an example of this. I was in Burma I was in Asia doing intensive meditation practice for a year and a half, one of my times in Asia. And during that time, I don't think I really knew anything about the news. I didn't follow the news. I mean, there were probably very important news. And I remember I came back, it was about 10 years later, I said, I kind of like people are talking about this thing. And I, what? And I think it was the Challenger explosion. Is that what it was? What it was? The space shuttle that exploded? That was a big thing, right? I had no idea what they were talking about. What? It's like, what's 9/11? You know, it's like I wasn't plugged into any of it. But that training that I got, that deeper inner work, was really crucial for who I am now as a teacher and how I can teach. And without having done that, I don't think I could be as an effective teacher as I am. And I hope I'm effective enough to make a difference. I hope that I have something to offer. That's my wish, and that's what I'm kind of... So there's a time for going inwards, there's a time for coming out. And there's a time to be engaged and a time to learn. And then there's a context of what? I mean, there's like so many tragedies and so much going on in this world. You'd be crazy if you tried to learn enough about all of it. So then you have to be wise about what you learn about so that you become informed in some area. You can't really know well a lot. But I think sometimes you can be more effective if you know one thing really well than if you know 100 things superficially, if you want to make a difference. So there's all kinds of choices to make. And you probably could never get it right. And that's why equanimity is important. That we try to do our best, we live our best effort, and we try to find our way. That's what, you know, that's the answer I have at the moment. The inner life is a precious thing. To be able to some way or other, to touch your own heart and settle it so that your heart is at peace and your heart touches into the wellsprings of compassion and care for our world and for ourselves, is one of the great things to do with life. And it's, I believe firmly, that the people who've been able to settle into their hearts in a deep way, resolve some of the conflicts and fears and resentments and challenges they have in their heart, have settled them away and discovered it kind of a deep, integral sense of peace, love, happiness, that they have so much more to offer the world. They can meet the world in beneficial ways and supportive ways. And that we, as a society, to generalize, as a society, I think we have a great need for it. We have a great need for people who know how to respond with other, you know, not respond with hate. And not only that, but to kind of like the question of people who are not compassionate in the world, how to respond to people who have hate and offer an alternative, a way that helps our society be a society where we live together in mutual care for each other. So I think that this deep inner work, spending time doing it, having the patience to do it, having the dedication to do it, and realizing how important it is to do, is a really important thing, because then people are more motivated to do it. If it's only like a little bit of stress reduction, you know, so I can just be not so stressful in my daily life, that's useful to do, but it's not really going to give a person tremendous motivation that this I'm going to do, yes. But if we can realize how powerful it is for ourselves in the world to clarify our heart, to purify our heart, do the inner work of self-understanding, come to some kind of profound level of peace and compassion for the sake of everyone, I mean, that is worth living for and spending time doing. Great. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for doing this today. I appreciate coming here and being with you. I hope you have a good week.